You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining us today on the show to talk about just war theory is Dr. Paul Miller, professor of practice of international affairs at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., in the area of which he lives with his wife and kids. Dr. Miller, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing great. It's snowy here in Washington, D.C., and I've been home with my kids all week, so that's been a lot of fun.
And presumably it will still be snowy by when this episode posts, although no promises about that.
Right.
We do have a couple of timely episodes coming up, including, I guess I shouldn't say what's coming up because this might post later. We are doing something on the rise and fall of Mars Hill. I didn't prep you for this, but have you been listening to that, and do you have thoughts on it?
I did listen to it, and it was good investigative journalism, revisiting a lot of things that I saw headlines about over the years. A lot of it felt vaguely familiar. You know, I have no personal firsthand experience with that particular church or churches in that network. But some of the culture that I think the podcast described did feel just a little familiar. Gosh, having said that, I need to say that's not a reflection on the churches I've been a member at for the last 20 years at all.
Sure.
I've been blessed to be part of healthy churches with godly pastors and elders where I don't think there's been any sort of culture of abuse of authority, anything like that. But it does seem to resonate with a broader evangelical culture.
Yeah, I'm impressed and very, very grateful to God that the leaders that you and I have been associated with for, like you said, the past 20 years, I don't know if this was wisdom on their part or just sheer providence. They have avoided all of that, and largely avoided the people involved with those sorts of issues.
Yeah, and I think that there is a lot of wisdom there. You know, one of the things when I was a member at you and I were members at Capitol Baptist, you know, there's a strong emphasis on a plurality of elders and congregational authority. Elders were accountable to and responsive to the members of the church. And I think that right there can really prevent a lot of the abuses that the Mars Hill podcast talked about. Just that kind of institutional setup, which I think is biblical and wise.
Right. And an institutional setup in more than just name, right? A robust culture of actively
yes.
pursuing that.
Yeah.
Well, we could talk Mars Hill all day, but I will direct listeners to our episode on that either in the future or in the past, depending on this one drops. And I would love to tie just war into Mark Driscoll and the Mars Hill Church, but we probably shouldn't do that.
No, there actually is a tie here because we're talking about ordered liberty, right?
Yeah.
Ordered liberty and how churches are set up in a way that it has good, godly, wise leadership, and yet leadership that is held accountable. And so you have a culture of ordered liberty within churches. And that's very much what I talk about in this book about just war. It's about ordered liberty among states and nations and how nations exercise authority and wield coercion and even lethal coercion for the purpose of upholding that kind of culture of ordered liberty. So there's a tie.
So other churches should have come along and imposed some ordered liberty on Mars Hill in Seattle.
Oh, boy. That's quite an application point there.
Hey, you know, I'm trying to tie it in. We should before talking about who should have imposed that on Mars Hill, maybe we should talk about what just war is, and to a lesser extent, what ordered liberty is. That's sort of the sub point for your book, right? If I'm remembering this correctly, it's been a little while. So just war, you break into three kind of historical phases, three approaches to just war: the Augustinian. The Westphalian, which I may be pronouncing wrong, it's one of those words I've only ever seen written, and then the contemporary or the liberal. Can you give us like a 2-minute overview of each of those phases of just war? And if people want all of the nuts and bolts, they can and should buy your book.
Yeah, Let me start by rewinding just a little bit with kind of two preparatory points. One is about my own background, so the listeners understand when I write about this stuff. This is a very academic book, but I write it from personal experience, having served in the U.S. Army, veteran of the war in Afghanistan, spent 10 years working on the war in Afghanistan from the Army, CIA, and the White House. So that's in the background, and I share about it in the book a little bit. Second preparatory note is that if any listeners have any exposure to just war, I'm guessing it's probably in their, you know, undergraduate sort of philosophy class or government class, and the just war that they got there was a checklist. To fight a just war, you have to A, have just cause, B, have right authority, C, have right intention. And then it varies after that. You know, the fourth criteria is like to fight with proper discrimination and proportionality and to make sure that war is last resort and all that kind of stuff. OK, so that's the checklist version of just war. If you read my book, you won't find the checklist in there. And that was on purpose. Just war thinking is a body of political theology developed largely by Christian theologians over a couple of millennia with a couple of pagan precedents and secular antecedents as well. It's about the nature of sovereignty that God has given to governments, the responsibility he has entrusted to them, and how and why they are supposed to wield authority on earth. That's what just war is really about. It's not a mere kind of shallow checklist. Okay, so that's my preparatory comments. When I looked at the history of this thinking, I found three different ways of thinking about sovereignty and war. And I named them the Augustinian, Westphalian, and liberal ways of thinking about the state and war. The Augustinian is, I think, the Christian tradition. It's a little bit inaccurate to say that Augustine founded the tradition because, again, there's precedents, there's people before him, and his writing is actually not terribly systematic, but it's helpful to use him as a paradigmatic thinker of that tradition. As a Christian tradition, it very much sees the state as holding and exercising authority on delegation from God and accountable to him for how and why it uses its authority. The state is supposed to use authority for the purpose of justice and peace, for the common good. That's a bit vague, but if you dig down a bit deeper, I think you can say that justice looks like the conditions that lead to the flourishing of the common good. It's a bit long-winded way of putting it, but the end result is the flourishing of the common good and all the people therein. That's what justice looks like in this Augustinian framework. And there's other concepts here, like natural law being, you know, rules inscribed in the created order that we're supposed to follow and all that. But that's the broad Augustinian tradition. After the wars of religion, the 16th and 17th centuries, the rulers in Europe kind of concluded that they could no longer agree on what all of that looked like. They couldn't agree on the true nature of justice. They couldn't agree on what is the good. They couldn't agree on Christian doctrine. So they kind of set aside a lot of those concepts, but kept on using some of the same language about justice and natural law. It just meant very different things. So in the Westphalian tradition, they no longer think of the state as having authority on loan from God. The state's authority, you know, they invented myths about the social contract and, you know, the state's legitimacy comes from our agreement to live under its rules. Sort of a myth, right? But the state's authority is kind of self-justifying in the Westphalian tradition. States exercise authority in order to exercise authority. They wield power in order to gain more power. It's essentially what the Westphalian tradition ended up concluding. For them, they can fight war to defend the state. So in the Westphalian tradition, war gets whittled down into defending borders. That's kind of the only way you can think of a just war in the Westphalian tradition. Borders exist. You shouldn't cross them with armed force. If somebody does invade you, you can fight back, and that's about it. It's a shrunken version compared to the Augustinian version when, you know, the Augustinians talked about waging war for the common good, for justice, for peace. There's a problem with the Westphalian tradition. It says nothing at all about crimes against humanity, atrocities, genocide, what the Augustinians called crimes against nature. And we saw that very visibly in World War II with the Holocaust and sadly many other examples of crimes against humanity. And so the liberal tradition really starts to arise after World War II as a response to that, trying to fix that problem. They still agree with most of what the Westphalians say, that we should defend borders and that crossing borders, invading countries is bad. But they also want to be able to say that we should use war to defend humans, right? That government ought to serve human life and human flourishing, human rights, they now say. And so if there's a mass violation of human rights and human dignity in the form of genocide or something like it, then maybe we could go to war for that too. It's a problem with the liberal tradition because that there's a tension. What if you have to cross borders with armed force in order to defend human rights? And the liberals have never really resolved that. But I can sort of sympathize with the effort, the inclination to want to recognize the sovereign's responsibility to do more than just defend borders. Defending borders isn't what states were really created for. It was created for something a bit more morally robust than that. That's my quick and dirty, and it was a bit more than 2 minutes each, but you know, I spent 20 years on this book, so I get more than right, 2 minutes to summarize it.
two minutes was more aspirational than anything, more guidelines than rules. So if our listeners want to read, say, the best articulation of each of those various each of those three positions, who would you send them to read?
So in the book, each chapter gets a. Each tradition gets a chapter, and then I have an additional chapter on the transition between the Augustinians and the Westphalians. I think you're going to read about the Augustinians. Read the section on Augustine, of course. It's what, 5 or 10 pages on Augustine, just so you get a flavor of that sort of founding tradition. On chapter 3, the transition, these are maybe some of my favorite thinkers, to be very honest. I would say read the section on Alberico Gentili. He's the first Protestant to ever make a contribution to just war thinking. Interesting guy. He was an Italian, which would lead you to believe he's probably a Catholic. He's living in the 16th century. It turns out he's an Italian Protestant who had to flee for his life, and he took up residence in England, where he was a professor of, I believe, jurisprudence at Oxford or something. Here, I'm rereading what I wrote years ago, teaching law at Oxford University. And I think that particular experience of fleeing what he would have believed to be an unjust government and find a rationale for explaining why what they were doing with their coercive powers was wrong. And yet at the same time, other governments did have right authority to uphold law and order in their realms. And Gentili also, I believe, supported the Dutch revolt against the Habsburg rule in the Netherlands. That led him to kind of develop a system for thinking about this. So Gentili is an interesting guy. In the Westphalian tradition, what's the one guy to read? I'd say Vattel, the last one in that chapter, Amer de Vattel, a Swiss jurist. He is a bit more clear to read. Pufendorf is very hard, and Wolff is just very pedantic. So Vattel is simply the easiest to read. And then finally, the liberal tradition, read this stuff on Paul Ramsey. It was a really great thinker. That chapter has one long treatment of Michael Walzer, who, again, if any readers have had any exposure to just war, it's probably through Michael Walzer, who wrote the most popular book, most widely used book on just war in the last 50 years. And I think there's quite a lot of problems with that book. So I'd say read the book on Paul, read the section on Paul Ramsey. It's good stuff.
Yeah. So you, anything else you want to say about any of those three traditions?
You know, the thrust of my argument as a whole is let's take the best, more or less of all three, but obviously I borrow more from the Augustinian and the liberal. Right. There's a few spots where I can kind of borrow a few concepts from the Westphalian, but my own approach in the last chapters of the book are the Augustinian liberal approach to just war. And that's where I try to, again, blend the best of what I find in the traditions beforehand.
Right. Yeah. It's the Westphalian that sort of falls by the wayside in your book for the most part. Which is interesting. I mean, you pointed out some of the problems with each of those, and I think one of the contemporary problems, given how interconnected the world is today compared to when these were all shaped, maybe excluding some of the end of the liberal tradition. But one of the problems that we would seem to run into is if we are pursuing the common good and, say, intervening in cases of genocide or what have you, that's a lot of intervention, right? There's always something going on somewhere in the world that's a violation of human rights. I'm not even an international affairs person. I could list four or five of them off the top of my head from the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So how if we adopt anything other than the Westphalian tradition, are we not just always at war?
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it a pathway to conquering the world in the name of saving it? And that is a really big problem and a challenge for the sort of approach I advocate. The first thing I want to say is to, if we look back, you know, I started this book largely because I had that question, like, is it justified to intervene? And I was kind of shocked to discover that the Augustinians directly addressed this. Francisco Suarez, Francisco de Vitoria, Hugo Grotius, they all wrote very explicitly on what we today call humanitarian intervention. For them, the problems were, they call it crimes against nature. They were thinking of cannibalism, piracy, things that we might call terrorism as well, terrorism on the high seas. They encountered those in their kind of military affairs of the day. And to a man, they agreed, yes, governments have the authority and the responsibility to do something about it. They can, in fact, use military force to fight against cannibals and pirates, right? And they developed their political theology around that idea. So I thought that was interesting that we're not the first people to encounter this idea since World War II. It's not really a new concept. But they were particular in saying that it had to be really extreme stuff because they understood, and I think we understand today, that there's a kind of a form of routine authoritarianism that is common throughout history. It is common throughout the world today that doesn't justify intervention. Right now, Saudi Arabia is one of the most authoritarian countries on the planet. It treats women, Shia, Christians like dirt. They have no rights. They're second-class citizens. Does that mean we should invade their country to free their people? No. Right, that's not a just cause. That's routine authoritarianism. I don't like it, but that doesn't obligate me to invade their country and overthrow their government. What the thinkers, the Augustinians, were talking about, and I think what we talk about today, are the really exceptional cases. Cases of genocide. What I say in the book is genocide and mass enslavement, I think, would justify an intervention on the grounds of humanitarian ideals. Today, I think that might actually hold in North Korea. I think North Korea is pretty close to that. I don't want to make a distinction. When I say North Korea, I'd say that it would be morally permissible, not morally obligatory, for us to intervene and set their people free. Permissible, not obligatory. I think it's a very different argument to say we have an obligation to intervene somewhere, which is not the argument I make. So really extreme cases of mass enslavement and genocide, that's what justifies an intervention. Even then, you still can come up with a list of four, five, or six possible interventions. So how do you limit that? Number one, as I just said, it's permissible, not obligatory. We have no obligation to go around the world setting people free. That's not what governments – that's not their primary obligation. The second kind of limiting factor is if you decide upon an intervention, what does that entail? And here is the really big thing that I think we've consistently screwed up for decades. We very rarely get it right when we sign up for an intervention. I think that was one of the main problems with the war in Afghanistan, one of many problems in the war in Iraq. That was certainly the problem in our intervention in Libya in 2011. We overthrew a government and walked away. We manufactured state failure. That was unjust. While my approach might expand the grounds on which an intervention might be fought, my same argument vastly expands the responsibilities that an intervention entails. And that should make governments pause before they sign up to intervene somewhere. If you're going to sign up to invade North Korea to set its people free, please understand you're signing up for a 2 or 3 decade commitment to overthrow a government and then stay to rebuild the place and set it on a positive trajectory of political and economic change. It's a massive standard it's a very high standard I'm trying to hold governments up to because the whole point of a just war is to leave behind a better peace. And that's precisely what we've failed to do in intervention after intervention. We're not leaving behind better peace. And if you're going to do the killing required to, again, use North Korea as an example, to overthrow a barbaric regime like that, it has to be worth it by building a better peace. And that's a huge investment and a huge responsibility.
And some of this we talked about when you were on the show to discuss Afghanistan right after we pulled out. So, again, we'll kind of direct our listeners back to that. Obviously, some of the calculus of just war for us is going to be the question of, are we capable of building a better peace? And I am very, very pessimistic about that. I think Americans just lack the self-reflection and imagination to successfully do that in other nations, and maybe even in our own nation, given the events of the past few years.
So I'm more skeptical about it today than I have been pretty much ever in my life. What I observe from history is we've done it in the past. You know, stereotypically, hey, look, we did it in West Germany. We did it in Japan.
Yeah, we've done it once, right? One time in history.
I'll say more than that. You know, I look at the Balkans. I look at the interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo and Serbia, and I'll say, actually, that worked out pretty well, right? It did take about 25 years, not of a full-up military occupation, but there was a small military presence, and there was a few billion in reconstruction assistance consistently for a decade or so. And it actually worked out pretty well. The Balkans today are better than they were. They're not, you know, it's not Paris, it's not Belgium, but they're better than they were. So I'm going to call that a success. And there's a few other examples of success of U.S. or U.N. interventions post 1990, Namibia and Mozambique, some stuff we did in Central America didn't turn out too badly. So you can find islands and pockets of success. I'm even going to say, you can look at the 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's not a perfect record of failure. Like, there's occasions when we got things right for a few years here or one province over there, when we did show a kind of proof of concept. So that is what leads me to believe it can be done. What I think we lack is the capability to learn from history. We lack a government bureaucracy dedicated to doing this right. And so every time we improvise we cobble together a kind of a collection of bureaucracies and international partners, and it's a mess every time. So it's never pretty. It's never efficient, but it can be done with enough time, resources, political will, and competence. My very first book was precisely on this subject, on how to do it right. So listeners can look at that, called Armed State Building.
Yeah, which I have not read. One of these days, I'll add that to my Paul Miller shelf. There are any number of kind of specifics like that we could bring up. I'm sort of interested in your historical analysis. Speaking of Americans learning for history, by your approach, then by your combination of Augustinian and liberal just war traditions, has America fought any unjust wars?
So the checklist version of just war leads us to labeling a war just or unjust, as if it's a light switch, like all just or all unjust. And I don't think of wars that way. I think most of them, probably all of them, are blends of some justice and some injustice. I think we have a pretty good track record, not perfect, but a pretty good track record of fighting wars on just pretexts. That is to say, we generally get the just cause right. I think that there's a pretty good argument about the Mexican-American, the U.S.-Mexico War, 1846, that maybe that was not fought on a just cause. Vietnam is another one where people argue how much justice was there. I actually think the justice of the cause of the Vietnam War is fairly straightforward, insofar as the people of South Vietnam certainly had the right to defend themselves from North Vietnam and the right to seek for international partners and allies. So I think there was a form of justice there.
Give you communism is really bad. I'll grant that part.
Yes. And this is where I disagree. Michael Walzer, I think his analysis of the Vietnam War is just absolutely horrible. It's really, really bad. Okay. Where we get into trouble more often is the justice of how we fight our wars. And actually, and my book is not really about that at all. It's not about jus in bello. But just wars, usually, you know, you say you have to fight with discrimination, proportionality, And it's pretty easy to find examples throughout history, but particularly in World War II, where we didn't do that. The carpet bombing of European cities and Japanese cities, we killed tons of civilians, and the claim to try to minimize the civilian casualties was paper thin. So I'm pretty sure some of our tactics in World War II were not just. People complain a lot about today, about us killing civilians, and what you need to understand is we're doing better than we ever have before. Our collateral damage done by our bombings is a minuscule fraction of what it used to be in World War II. So I'm actually fairly happy with how the U.S. military in particular and our European allies have worked hard to minimize that kind of stuff. Now, where we fail the most in the justice of our wars is the justice after war, which is the whole burden of my argument in the last chapters of the book, is to argue about how you end wars justly. And we do this pretty badly. We did it right in World War II. We did it wrong in World War I. We tried to do it right in the Civil War through a decade of Reconstruction and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. But then we gave up after 1877. And essentially, you know, gave up on the moral purpose of the Civil War by ending Reconstruction too early. And look, America is still the worse off for it today. 160 years later, America's still worse off for it. Reconstruction didn't go far enough. So we again, abandoned the moral purpose of the war, and that introduced some injustice to how that war ended. And I think, again, that is a similar kind of problem that had plagued Iraq and Afghanistan. I looked at Iraq and the justice of the beginning of that war pretty carefully, and I went back and forth on it over the years, but I ultimately concluded it was, in fact, morally permissible to initiate the war in Iraq. That doesn't mean it was prudent or wise, but it was morally permissible because of, you know, Saddam Hussein's regime was barbaric and broke international law and on and on and on. It never really ended the war of 1991. They never acceded to the peace demands of the 91 war. And of course, I think the war, initiating the war in Afghanistan, self-evidently just because of the 9/11 attacks. But we ended those wars so badly, and it led to a worse outcome. And I think that that introduces an element of injustice in both of those wars.
Right. I think the problem here is by making it a question of intention, right? You run into sort of on the one hand, well, yeah, of course people are going to give the just answer when you ask why are we going to war, right? Of course the politician is going to say, well, here's my just reason. No one's going to say because I want oil or because we want Mexico's land or because.
Right.
Whatever, right? You're always going. So now we're having to sort of parse the real meaning behind the political facade, and I think that's always something of a challenge. Not least because I generally tend to think politicians are telling the truth. Like I tend to think politicians really believe. So I think George H.W. Bush really believed it was wrong to invade Kuwait, and that's why we're going to kick Iraq out. And George W. Bush really believed Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. I think that was probably genuine on his part. And yet, that's not the same thing as saying the government as a whole, right, is pure in its intentions, as opposed to what they're saying publicly. So how do we parse that sort of on the one hand? And then the other question is, well, what intentions are, like, what are the intentions that really count? The public facade or the behind the scenes ones?
That's a really great question. How do you measure intent and what counts? And I go into some detail on that as I discuss the war in Iraq in the final chapter of the book. I think that Tony Blair and George Bush personally probably had the right motives, right? As you say, it's, you know, politicians, they want to believe that they're the good guys. And so they often say the right things and maybe even believe they're doing the right things and they're the good guys. Did their intentions bear out over the repeated pattern of behavior of their governments and their militaries over the subsequent 8 years of the war, the occupation, the counterinsurgency? And I think the answer is no, right? You look at the decisions the U.S. government corporately made as a whole and how it chose to fight that war from 2003 up through 2006, and I think that it does not evidence the intention of fighting for peace and justice for Iraqis, right? We fought a bad war in those years. I think we rediscovered our right intention in 2007 and 8 with the surge, and I think we abandoned it in 2011 with the withdrawal. And so as a whole, not looking at any individual actor, I look at the U.S., the pattern of behavior by the U.S. government and its allies, and I conclude that there's no, there's no evidence that our intention to fight for peace and justice for Iraqis won out. That didn't seem to be the primary motivation. If it had been our primary motivation, our behavior would have been different. We would have made different choices and fought a different kind of war.
Yeah, and I think that's a good transition. Is a good transition point into the question. Well, what should we be fighting for? What is the ordered liberty that just war is designed to pursue?
Yeah. So that's my argument. Is that I kind of try to reformulate the Augustinian and liberal traditions and say that the ordering principles, the legitimizing principles of war, should be ordered liberty. So I can answer just with those words and say the answer is ordered liberty. Okay. But that begs the question: what does it look like? You know, can you be more specific? I'll say part of the answer is the case studies in the back of the book. I try to get more specific by going through specific. I go through Iraq, Afghanistan, the war on terror, Syria, North Korea, cyber war. And that is where I try to answer the question more specifically. What does it look like? It is a bit hard to translate these abstract principles. And I don't think there's a formula, right? I'm not sure that's quite the right answer. The other answer is give me about two more books, and I intend to write a book on ordered liberty. So I'll get there someday.
Yeah, so I think you use Iraq in your book as a case study, but I think there's kind of an interesting precursor to that. So if we go back and look at Iraq in 1991, right? There's a dispute over oil fields where, to some extent, Iraq actually has kind of a legitimate claim. Saddam Hussein overreacts, invades Kuwait, kicks him out. George H.W. Bush has almost a Westphalian response, right? That's one nation invading another nation. That's not okay. Just because the Cold War is over, we're not going to allow this sort of aggression to go on. Kicks the government of Iraq out of Kuwait. End of the story. Now, from a Westphalian perspective, I think that's clearly slam dunk just war, right? As you presented it in the book. I say that. I'm no expert there.
By every tradition, nobody disagrees. That's I think the Augustinians would agree, and the liberals would agree that that's a just war. No one disagrees that it's we all have justice to defend our nations and ourselves from invasion. Yes.
Sure. Within that limited perspective, certainly from the perspective of Kuwait, right? From that view, yeah, this is a just war, and we had an alliance with Kuwait. We depended on them for oil. That was certainly a factor as well. If it had been, you know, Azerbaijan that Saddam Hussein had invaded and conquered, I don't know that we would have had the same response, but it wasn't. With that said, the government of Kuwait, to the best of my knowledge, and again, this is far more your field than mine, is an orderly government. I don't know that we'd say it's a free government. It's not a, you know, the end result of that war was not ordered liberty, except insofar as the national borders were reestablished. So yeah. Iraq was not a nation of ordered liberty. Kuwait was not a nation of ordered liberty. Saudi Arabia certainly is not a nation of ordered liberty. Is that then a defensible war if all it does is restore the ordered non-free status quo that existed beforehand?
No, great question. And in fact, there's a very short discussion of this in the book, because Walzer makes a comment about this when he's talking about interventions, and he essentially says the Gulf War was just, and I think he says we had no business. Exactly what does he say? He's very dismissive of the challenge you just raised. He doesn't think there's any problem with reestablishing the autocracy that existed before the war, putting the al-Sahab family back on the throne. And I take issue with that. I think that the Gulf War was a just war, but again, I'm not sure that the peace was optimally just. We restored borders. That was a good thing. We could have used the moment to push for some liberalization in Kuwait, and we didn't. And I think that was a missed opportunity. And I think it was wrong to overlook that opportunity. Does it make the entire war unjust? No, not at all. But it does show again that the United States does a poor job in the aftermath of war, trying to establish broad conditions of peace and justice for everyone.
Well, and it's certainly the case that the people of Kuwait were better off under the government they had after the war than they would have been under Saddam Hussein.
I don't know. Yes. Oh, yeah. Sure. Absolutely.
there's some liberty there, right? In that sense.
Yeah.
Still, I think it's sort of interesting that in that war, at least, ordered liberty. I mean, we're having to use liberty in such a wide ranging sense that it functionally might as well not even be there. We're just concerned with the order side of things.
Well, let's talk about Vietnam for a second. I defended the justice of the cause in Vietnam a bit ago, as North Vietnam was an aggressor and was invading the South through guerrilla warfare for 7 or 8 years from 1954 onward. And we really started to ramp up our intervention in 1961 and then a dramatic escalation in 1965. Ramsey argues that the Vietnam War ultimately is unjust because it is not proportional. We killed too many people for the result that we could have achieved, right? As I've thought through the Vietnam War, I think, and I don't put this in the book, so I'm not in writing, I'm not committed to this, but I think 1963 is the moment when it may have become an unjust war. That's when a military coup happened and overthrew the previously elected government in South Vietnam and installed a military dictator who stuck with it for almost the rest of the war. At that point, first of all, the war maybe have become unwinnable because the South Vietnamese government was too corrupt and autocratic to win the loyalty of its people. But I'm also not certain what we were fighting for at that point. We were fighting against the communists, but what were we fighting for? Were we fighting for ordered liberty? No, we were fighting on behalf of a corrupt autocratic regime. And maybe that's when we should have stopped fighting. That's a kind of a hypothesis I'm thinking out loud, but as I think about Vietnam, that might be when the opportunity to achieve ordered liberty in Vietnam disappeared, and thus we should have stopped fighting it then.
Well, and that is the case with so much of our Cold War conflict, right? I mean, same thing in South Korea. South Korea was not a bastion of freedom in the 1950s. It may have been elected. Their government may have been elected. I think it was a one-party state, though, right?
It was. And, here I'm going to argue against myself. You're correct. We fought on behalf of an autocratic government in South Korea. And in 1953, when we accepted the armistice, they were still autocratic. But then essentially through a lot of our benign influence over 3 decades, they did transition to democracy.
Right.
So maybe that's the argument on behalf of allying with autocrats, is we can help them transition. That's what sort of hawks always argue, but it's happened very few times.
Right, yeah. Right. And often bites us in the rear, especially when you get into later Cold War conflicts. Well, I think those are the big questions I had out of your book. Anything else you want our listeners to know about a just war and or ordered liberty?
You know, as I was talking about South Vietnam and fighting on behalf of a corrupt autocratic government, I expect some listeners are going to say, ah, that's why we also should have pulled out of Afghanistan. And I'm going to disagree with that. I think the government in Afghanistan was certainly corrupt, but it was not authoritarian and autocratic in the same way. It was not a military regime. Right. It was not autocratic in the same way the South Vietnamese government was. I think that we did have the opportunity to build something approaching ordered liberty in Afghanistan, even up to the very end. Early on, we certainly had that opportunity. In 2002 through 2005, the sky's the limit. If we had really dedicated ourselves to reconstruction, stabilization, the world would look a lot different, and Afghanistan would look dramatically different. We didn't. We had a light footprint, and that was a mistake. Taliban came back, launched an insurgency, and so the range of possible outcomes began to shrink. I think it was still right for us to stick around and do our best. I think Obama's surge was the right call, but the withdrawal deadline was not. And so, again, the range of possible outcomes shrunk, and it shrunk in a negative direction. It kept sort of pointing downwards. We had a sustainable strategy. 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. It was a strategy of, you know, a couple thousand troops, airstrikes, and keeping the Afghan army in the field. It's not optimal, but it was sustainable. It kept, it defended our interests, kept Al-Qaeda at bay, kept the Taliban from taking over the country. That's a low bar compared to what we could have achieved back in 2002, but it was still better than what we have today. I think President Trump's peace deal with the Taliban and President Biden's withdrawal were unjust. They were wrong. They betrayed the Afghan people. They betrayed our security interests, and it gave an unjust ending to that war, which otherwise had been, I think, just up to that point. And I'm afraid that we're going to see the consequences play out in future years.
Well, we're already seeing the consequences. I mean, it's...
Yeah. I probably just repeated a lot of what we talked about in August. I can't remember.
Sure. Dr. Miller, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. As always, it's fun to talk with you, Coyle. Thanks.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/City of Man Podcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.